You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and we're here to bring out the best in your pet's behavior. So if you need help understanding why animals do some of the interesting things they do, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls this hour, we'll also be kicking off our three-week For the Love of a Dog topic series, and it's based on Patricia's new book, which helps us understand our pet's emotions. So, Tricia, what will we be talking about this week?
Well, there's no question we all have emotions, right?
Sure.
Well, this hour, we're going to explore the biology of emotion, and we're going to talk about whether animals experience emotions like we do.
I get emotional just thinking about it.
Aww. You know,
we'll also talk with an author and long-distance swimmer about how an early morning swim turned into something of an adventure. But first, we have some callers waiting online, so let's go to those calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Emily from West Palm Beach, Florida.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have kind of a bizarre question. I have a cat that's about a year and a half old now, and she tries to nurse herself.
Herself?
Yes.
What does she do? Describe it to us.
Well, she pretty much just, you know, like, nuzzles in there and starts, you know, sucking on her own nipple.
No kidding. Oh, honey.
Yes.
Oh, did boy. She, where did you get her? Did she have some kind of a difficult beginning in life?
Not that I know of. I got her from the Humane Society, and she had a sister with her. And I only took her, and I noticed this probably a few weeks to a month, no, probably not that long, maybe 2 weeks after I got her, I noticed that she was doing this. And I took her to the vet for her regular checkup, and I asked the vet about it, and she gave her, like, a little sock cast body thing to wear so that she wouldn't suck on it and wouldn't get irritated.
Yeah.
And she told me to try the chewing spray that dogs use.
Like bitter apple or something?
Yeah, and I've tried putting a cone on her so that she couldn't get to it. I've tried spraying her with water. I've tried, like, swatting her or just trying to pay a lot of attention to her when she starts, and nothing really seems to stop her.
So it sounds like this is obsessive, right?
Yeah,
it sounds
sure
like
does.
This is not something she does on occasion. This is something she does often.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, pretty much when she starts to groom herself or right before she goes to sleep or something, and she doesn't do it as much as she used to.
Good.
But she definitely still does it.
You're describing a kitten who very probably had some kind of a disrupted developmental period, probably was taken away from mother too soon, maybe the mother didn't allow her to suckle. You often see that drive to suckle is so innate and so strong that if baby mammals don't have an opportunity to do it from their mother, they will often do it on each other, for example.
Oh.
On their litter mates, you see the calves often have problems. Trying to suckle on something if they're taken away from their moms, for example. So your cat just came up with a creative alternative based on the flexible spine of a cat, which is phenomenally flexible. The fact that she's getting better is really, really good. I would continue putting something bitter just on her nipples, because we don't want to stop her grooming her coat, so don't just spray her whole belly. But I would put something very bitter right on her nipples. What I would do is when she starts, I would distract her. I would distract her and give her something else to do, but I wouldn't make a huge deal of it. If it's decreasing, it's now gotten to maybe 5 times a day and it only lasts for 2 minutes, I would continue doing what you're doing. I think if you made a major event of it, actually you could end up making it worse.
Okay.
The thing with the bitter stuff is she really seems to like it.
Oh, well, that's a problem.
Like, she almost, like, it. She doesn't, you know.
It has no effect on her whatsoever.
Doesn't stay away from the area, doesn't anything. She just, the only thing that she doesn't like about it is the squirting sound.
What you might want to do is see if there's something else that she doesn't really like the taste of very much. Cats often don't like citrus, for example. So
like
you might,
or something.
Yeah, you might find some kind of a, make sure it's suitable for tender tissue. But
yeah, that's what I was wondering. Would that hurt her?
Not if you used a product. Don't use a product that you would, like, spray in the air, but if you used a product that was suitable for humans.
Like lemon juice?
Lemon juice could be okay. It's very drying, though. But what about a moisturizer that has, like, orange scent in it or something like that? Cats don't tend to.
She likes to lick lotion.
But what's important is not just this lotion, it's what it smells like. Because cats, if they read. Now, This is only if they read the chapters. And apparently she did not read the chapter on not liking bitter.
Right.
So she might not read the chapter on not liking citrus. So then I would suggest teaching her to read. And Larry can
get her to read.
Larry can tell you how to do that. But try, you know, you can have experiment with things that are safe for human skin, for sort of tender tissue that doesn't taste good to her.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call if you'd like to join in. You know, Patricia, we received an email from Anita in Jeju, Korea, and she must be listening on the web.
Well, that's fun.
Yeah, she'd like to know how much living space cats actually need, and here's what she writes. It's tough to afford bigger housing in crowded cities, so I have a studio apartment. I would love a kitten, but she'd be inside only, and I'd like to make sure that she's happy and healthy. So with that in mind, should I get a goldfish instead, or will one or two kitties be okay in a studio apartment?
What a great question, and good for her for asking about the welfare of her kitty. And here's the good news. Even a small studio apartment has a lot of vertical space, and that's what cats like particularly.
Oh.
So if you have the room to bring in cat trees, if you're creative and you can create a lot of areas where your kitty can go upwards, sleep up high, have little areas to run and play that uses up and down vertical space rather than horizontal space, you well might be fine, particularly if you look for, I wouldn't take a cat from the street, for example. I mean, that would be a very difficult switch for a cat who's used to being outside. And I wouldn't get an active breed. I wouldn't get an Abyssinian. I wouldn't get some of the breeds that are sort of famous for being super athletic. And
what about the other way? Which ones are not?
There are ragdolls or sort of known. I mean, look at the name. And just your basic sort of standard variety, American short hair, American long hair, they tend to call them. But they're not really American. They're just sort of standard non-designer gene cats. They vary tremendously in personality, and some of them are very, very active. Some of them are sort of quieter. So I would look for either a cat from a line, a mother and father who are very mellow, or look for a breed from a breeder, of breeds that tend to be relatively mellow, and then create a lot of vertical space, and I think you'd be fine.
Wonderful. And if someone else would like to email us a question, how do they do that?
Oh, it's easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Bill from Bristol, Wisconsin.
Hey, Bill. Thank you for calling.
I have a 9-year-old yellow lab named Bailey, and Bailey has an eating disorder, and by that I mean she eats everything.
It's not a disorder to her, right?
No, she seems to enjoy it quite a bit. Actually, she has eaten raw potatoes, entire loaves of bread. In fact, yesterday she ate 1.5 loaves of bread.
Oh, yeah.
When she was younger, about 7 months old, she would actually chew up and digest and pass aluminum cans.
Oh, dear.
I don't know how, but it didn't kill her. She's eaten turkey carcasses, and I cannot think or find a way to dissuade her from getting up on these countertops and stealing all of this food.
So that's really the bottom line.
That's the problem.
Is she's stealing all this stuff from the countertop.
Exactly.
So here's one thing you might have tried. Have you tried? There's a device you can buy. It's called a scat mat. It's a plastic mat, and you put it on top of an area you don't want an animal on. And Bailey would then jump up, get this little tiny carpet shock, and go like, oh, that wasn't so fun anymore. So that's certainly one possibility. Let me ask you one question. Does Bailey do this when you're home or when you're gone?
She only does it when we're not looking. And I know that she knows it's wrong because there are times where I will come home, and immediately when I walk in the door, she has that shag dog look on her face, like all dogs get when they're being disciplined.
Right.
But I don't, and I know she's not picking up on something from me because I don't even know what she's done yet.
Sure. But she knows that if she's taken something from the counter maybe 3 hours before, and you walk in the door, in times past, you did something that made it clear to her that you weren't happy, right?
So correct.
That cowering and, quote, guilty look that a lot of people define as guilty, it's actually called appeasement behavior. And what it means is, okay, given that there's a chewed up tin can on the living room rug now, I need to get all like, oh, cowery. So I appease him from getting angry at me. And something you said I think is so important, and I want to pick up on it. It relates to Bailey and it relates to so many of our pets. You said, I know she knows. That concept turns out not to be a useful concept. And the reason I say this, let me give you an example. How many people listening know the speed limit?
I know the speed limit.
And Larry, does that mean every single time you drive, because we know you know that you always obey the speed limit every single time?
I usually go 3 or 4 miles above it.
He's admitting to 3 or 4 miles above.
Which probably means he's doing 10 or 15.
Carefully stated. And so, you know, and think of it another way. Does a professional athlete know how to hit a perfect serve, for example? Does a tennis player know how to hit a perfect serve? Yes, but that doesn't mean they can do it all the time. So this sort of, I know, they know, it's not useful. Just throw it out the window. What is useful is thinking about, okay, what can I do that's going to discourage her that has nothing to do with me. And so you need what we call a remote correction, meaning she sort of self-corrects herself. She jumps up on the counter and something sort of yucky happens. So I would do two things. I would use a scat mat. I would create some kind of Rube Goldberg device where if she jumps up, a whole pyramid of cans or something falls down on her head. But here's something I think is more important. When you leave her with hollow toys stuffed with food that she can lick out. You might want to stuff a couple hollow toys, put them in the freezer, and then take them out and give them to her before you go. So she has something to do that's on the ground that's appropriate because she's entertaining herself. So give her something to do that's appropriate. You might want to exercise her a little bit more so she's also a little less interested in shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And entertaining herself. So keep trying to find something that discourages her from jumping up, but at the same time, I want you to give her a reason to stay down.
Give that a try.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number for you to call. And let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Tim from Milwaukee.
Tim, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I wanted to make the callers aware, you know, your viewers or listeners aware of a program, you know, for donating blood, that dogs and canines can donate blood for other canines and felines that have had traumatic injuries or surgery.
Interesting.
I had a female boxer who was six or seven when she started. And she went for an interview to see her temperament, and then they did, you know, a blood draw on her. And she passed with flying colors, and she had a great temperament. She was a wonderful girl.
Aww. What a great, great thing
wonderful.
To alert listeners to. That's just, I think that's so important, and I think a lot of people would really enjoy knowing that their dog was helping other dogs. Do you have any advice for people about if, you know, who live all over the country, about who they would contact about that? Is there a website, a national website?
I would contact
your
local vet, and they can put you in contact with emergency clinics. The Animal Emergency Center in Milwaukee is open 24 hours, and it's basically a trauma center.
And, you know, there are more and more, as I'm sure you know, more and more emergency clinics all around the country for our pets. And that would probably be the best thing to do, mm-hmm. is to find the closest emergency clinic to you and work through them. That's just a
wonderful
idea.
Advice.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tim, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. If you'd like to join us, here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. And coming up next, we'll explore the topic of emotions and find out whether our pets actually experience emotions just like we do. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. This week, we begin our special topic series based on Patricia's new book called For the Love of a Dog, Understanding Emotion in You and Your Best Friend. And Patricia, first, what do we know about emotion?
Well, one of the things we know about emotions is that they're very primitive. They're very primitive things, and they're designed to help animals make decisions, not necessarily conscious ones, but deciding, you know, what's in its best interest.
Okay.
They are generated in mammals in a part of the brain called the limbic system. It's even called the mammalian brain, as a matter of fact, because it's found in all mammals.
So how do we know if animals like our dogs and cats have emotions like we have emotions?
Well, that's a great question, isn't it? I mean, it really is. And one of the things we know, as mentioned, is that animals like our cats and our dogs have anatomical structures in their brain that are very similar to the ones that we have that generate emotions. So they have the amygdala, they have a hippocampus, they have all these areas of the brain that mediate emotion, just like they do in us. Dogs also, as do cats and sheep and horses, have the same neurotransmitters and the same hormones that create emotions in us. So they have the same physiology.
Okay.
They have the same anatomy, same physiology. And additionally, dogs, for example, express emotions on their faces in ways very similar to the way we express emotions. So if you look at it, you know, sort of if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, this is not shocking evidence to many dog lovers, right? All the evidence, if you look at it critically as a scientist, the evidence suggests that we share a great deal of our emotional life with our dogs and with other pets.
Well, as a layperson here, I'm just wondering, how do you even study emotion?
For so many years, you really couldn't study it scientifically. You know, it was B.F. Skinner, the noted, noted American psychologist whose work I talk about all the time in terms of how to train animals, how to influence animal behavior. But he argued in the 40s, 50s, that we shouldn't talk about emotions as scientists because we couldn't quantify them. You know, emotions are or were internal and subjective, and they were beyond the ability of science to look at quantitatively. So it just wasn't a subject, he argued, that scientists should talk about.
But that's no longer true.
That was then, and this is now. Yeah. That's right. That is no longer true. Recent advances in neurobiology allow us to compare to really truly look rigorously at a comparison of the experience of emotions in animals with that of people.
Okay, so it appears that much of the emotional life of dogs and people are similar, but what are the differences between the emotional life of dogs and people?
There are differences, and I think the differences probably relate to what are called the basic emotions like fear and anger and happiness, which are probably very shared, and the more, quote, complicated ones like jealousy, for example. Do dogs really experience jealousy? Well, there's some scientists who argue they don't. I'm here to say, yeah, they do. It's just it's very simple. It's, you know, I'm angry, he's got it, I don't, I'm mad. I mean, I don't think it's complicated. But another one of the, quote, complex emotions, guilt, for example, I think we often attribute to dogs, but inappropriately so. I think we're very quick to imagine our dogs being guilty when, for example, they're cowering at the door because they've jumped up on the counter, they had an accident on the rug. But guilt, if you think about it, guilt requires an understanding of a social moral code. That's pretty complicated. You know, a whole set of ethics and morality, I think that might be too much for dogs. But ironically, it's the emotion we often attribute to our dogs. So if you look at it, it appears that a great deal of our internal life, you know, our sort of internal mental and emotional life, is granted very different than a dog, but we share a lot, too. And I think it deserves our attention.
Yeah. You know what else deserves our attention?
What's that?
Our callers.
Well, what a segue. This is why Mueller makes the big bucks, don't you think? Is he slick or what?
Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413, and here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Virginia in Buffalo, New York.
Virginia, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a wonderful 6-year-old cat named Seamus. He's neutered, and he's quite a hunter. And we also have recently adopted a kitten.
Okay.
He was also male.
Yeah.
Also neutered. And he went out not too long ago, and he came back with a rabbit, a small rabbit.
Oh.
It was already dead.
Okay.
So I thought, well, let's see what happens. And he actually gave the rabbit to the kitten.
Oh.
First, he showed him what to do, and I don't want to be too gross about this.
Yeah,
he opened
really?
It, and he took what he wanted, and then he sat back, and he gave the rabbit to the kitten and essentially showed him what to do. And I would kind of expect that of a female cat. My female wants nothing to do with this baby. Nothing. No maternal instincts there at all that I can tell. But the male plays with him, grooms him, keeps him in line, sleeps with him.
What a
good
daddy. And has
now brought home breakfast. dinner, I guess it was.
And that's just fascinating. You're absolutely right. That is normally behavior attributed to the queen, right? To females who, at a particular age in development, start bringing prey home to their kittens and will actually open it up for them. Because what you find is that if an older cat doesn't do that, very often you'll get cats who know how to kill prey because that's instinctual. It's pretty hardwired. But then once they kill them, they don't do anything with them unless they've been shown by an elder.
Right.
And it usually is indeed a female. I love that this is a male. You know, I think if you look at all the species that we live with, cats and dogs and horses, there's great variation amongst them, as we all know. I mean, all of us who live with animals know that individuals are very different. And so you get these extra great daddies. You know?
Yeah, some of us males are nurturing good daddies.
I was just thinking of Larry. I was just about Larry to say something about what a great dad Larry is. I think you should call Seamus parentheses Larry.
Well,
the
we
great
call him
daddy.
Uncle Seamus.
Uncle Seamus. Uncle Larry, who's a great daddy. And Uncle Seamus, but it's just a great story.
Oh, thank you for sharing that with us, Virginia.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I really enjoy your show.
Oh, thanks for listening.
Thank you so much. And we have lots of people who love the show. Maybe you do, too. And if you do, you can call us. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Lee from Norman, Oklahoma.
Hello, Lee.
Pleasure to talk to you all.
Nice to talk to you. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a 2 or 3 year old dog. We're not quite sure. We got her from a shelter. And she's an English Springer Spaniel. And she is great at learning simple commands. We taught her sit, stay, holding a treat on her nose until we say she can have it. All of these sorts of little things.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in getting her to learn some more complex tasks. You know, something like maybe an agility course.
Yeah, good
taking,
for you.
Yeah, and it's great in picking up her toys and putting them away, maybe something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hoping to get your opinions.
Oh, yeah, well, good for you. I think so many dogs are under-exercised mentally. You know, most people know their dogs need more physical exercise. But I think a lot of us forget that our dogs have very active brains, and they were basically designed to do a lot of problem solving during the day. So there's all kinds of great stuff you can do. There's
sure.
a kind of a Amazon for dog books.
Huh.
It's called Dogwise, dogwise.com. If you go there and click on tricks, they have some books and videos that are great for coming up with creative tricks to teach your dog. One is called Take a Bow Wow. I did not make up that title. Don't look at me. But there's Take a Bow Wow. There's Take a Bow Wow 2. Those have some great tricks on them. There's also a book called Nose Work for Dogs, which is about scent discrimination tricks, which are really fun because it creates a whole other perspective that involves the world that dogs live in that we don't share, which
sure.
is the world of their nose. And things like you can actually teach your dog, did the water that came out of the fountain come from the cold water pipe or the hot water pipe because they smell different. So there's just the world is your oyster, basically, and good for you. It sounds like you have a dog who's just ready to go to graduate school.
Oh, mm-hmm. she is.
Another thing you might want to think about are going to local classes. My business dog's best friend, we have a tricks and games class. And you can teach simple things like take a bow, to teach a dog to roll up in a blanket when you say nighty-night. You know, I mean, really cute stuff.
Oh,
so
cool.
Look at your local classes. There's agility, there's tracking, and there's probably a tricks and games class not too far from you. So that's another idea.
And what was that website address again that you gave?
Dogwise.com.
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 Lee, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll talk to an author whose early morning swim turned into a whale of an adventure. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week we welcome Lynn Cox to the program. Lynn is well known as the woman who broke the men's and women's world record for swimming across the English Channel at the age of 15. She also swam 1 mile to the shores of Antarctica and wrote about it in her book, Swimming to Antarctica. And her latest book is called Grayson. It's a story about an early morning workout that didn't go quite as planned, and she's joined us today to talk about it. Hello, Lynn Cox.
Hello, how are you?
Well, just great. Tell us about that early morning swim. What happened that day?
I had gone to work out before the sun had risen. I was trying to get my workout done before I got home to do my high school homework, and I sort of got waylaid. I had planned just to do a couple-mile swim, and suddenly there was something very large swimming underneath me, and I couldn't tell what it was because the water was pitch black and the sky was pitch black, and I kept looking for a fin to see if it was a shark or a dolphin, because you can tell that by looking at the fin. The dolphin fin is a little bit more angular and the shark fin is more up and down, but there was nothing visible. And so I swam very quickly back to the pier, and there's an old man named Steve who used to watch over me who was waving his arms frantically, and I thought, yep, it's a shark, get out of the water now. And he shook his head, and so I popped my head up and he said, you can't go ashore now, Lynn. There's a baby gray whale. He lost his mom, and if you go ashore, he'll follow you and go aground and die. So you have to stay out here and help him find his mom.
Oh, that just must have been an amazing experience to be in the water with something so huge.
It was daunting, you know, to have a being that's 18 feet long swimming right up next to you and around you and under you. And, you know, the thing, though, is that if you do any research or reading about the gray whales, they tend to be like the Labradors of the ocean. They are very big, gentle, sweet beings. And so I was fortunate enough to know this, but still, to have a puppy, you know, the baby whale coming right at you, you're sort of like, okay, I hope he knows not to jump on me.
And you did try to communicate with the baby whale. And how did you do that?
Well, he was sort of grunting and sort of a kind of a squeaking sound. And so I tried to imitate him, but I got water up my nose and realized that this was not going to work because I didn't know what he was saying to me. And I didn't know what I was trying to parrot back. So between the two of those things, I guess the idea was then that you just start sensing the other being near you and realizing that he has sonar and that he can probably sense what's going on with me through his sonar. Sharks have sensors in their nose where they can detect magnetic forces in the water, and I think that the sensing devices of the whales are probably better than even the sharks.
So you stayed with this baby whale in hopes of reuniting him with his mother. What convinced you or gave you hope that you could find this baby whale's mother in this huge ocean that you were swimming in?
I think it was that I didn't know enough. You know, as you get older, you realize that sometimes the things that you do are really dumb. And why did you even think you could do that? Well, that's where when I was 17 years old, that's what I was sort of thinking, that maybe if I just stay with the baby, that in and of itself will be helpful. And, you know, I just felt like in real life, when you're around other people, when they're going through something that's difficult, just being there, just holding somebody's hand makes all the difference in the world. And so my idea was to stay with Grayson, but the problem was that he decided to swim about a mile and a half offshore. And there was this conflict because my folks had said, you know, never swim offshore without a paddler beside you or a kayaker or a boat or something like that. And so I was trying to figure out, what do I do? And I thought, you know, sometimes you just have to do what you think is right. And so I stayed with him, and we sort of searched for about 4 hours way offshore looking for his mom.
And as I remember, you mentioned your mom and dad. You were in high school, were you not?
I was in high school at the time, but I wanted to write this in a way that I reflected back 30-something years later to be able to integrate philosophy. You know, we have these big moments in life where suddenly you can do something that might make a difference, or it might make a great difference, or you have the choice of just walking away or swimming away from it. And I just felt like I needed to write about the bigger things in life and connect it to the story so that it wasn't just this adventure about a baby gray whale that gets lost and do you find his mom, which is all really important and which carries you through the story. But I wanted to say something a lot more meaningful and with more depth than just that.
It sounds as though this experience with Grayson had a big impact, as you say, not just on how you feel about whales, but also on how you feel about other sea life.
Oh, huge, because it made me realize that, you know, even though you're a different being from the different part of Earth, that you can connect with them. I remember a friend of mine, you know, once you tell stories about animals in the water, you hear about from other friends and other people that you haven't met yet along the way, you meet along the way, about what their experiences are with animals. There's a guy named Douglas Chatwin who writes about whales, and he talked about being in the lagoons off Baja and how a mother gray whale took her baby and put it on her stomach, rolled over, put it on her stomach, and sort of presented the baby to him.
Mm-hmm.
And you just hear these things and you think, wow, we are, you know, we are amazing animals, but all these other animals are even as amazing, if not more so. And we sort of were really, I was lucky because I was actually in this moment in time where I get to see this baby whale who then came over to me and rolled over and looked at me eye to eye, and I could see that, you know, somehow we were connecting. And there were other people out there on boats that were searching for this baby's mother and lifeguards. And then we heard a report from Huntington Beach that, which was about 10 miles south of us, that the mother whale was coming in our direction. So it was really cool how other people got involved and really wanted to help as well.
And you had named that baby whale Grayson. And how did you come up with that name, by the way?
Well, you know, when you're with something for a while, you need to, I sort of name it. And I've had these different experiences in life where I've tried to help animals and sometimes help them and sometimes they've died. But this one was the son of the gray whale. And so I figured son of the gray whale, well, that's kind of too long to call him that. And I thought, oh, gray son, Grayson. And that's how he got his name.
This was a kind of an early experience for you in terms of at least with a whale and while you were out in the ocean. But how did that experience shape your appreciation for gray whales and other sea life?
You know, up until that point, I'd done a little bit of research, and I realized that they were sort of the supreme endurance swimmers that would swim all the way from Baja up along the California coast and Washington and Oregon all up to the Bering Strait. And that distance of swimming is something like 7,000 miles. So I was sort of in awe of all that. But there's so many other things that are unique to the gray whales that, you know, that make them really fascinating. And I think that one of that is that they're so approachable. But they also, the reason I couldn't find them in the water initially, or the baby whale, was because I couldn't spot a dorsal fin because they don't have dorsal fins. You know, and it was only after being around him that I realized that there are dimples along the back of his spine, and that's what he uses for diving. It's sort of like, maybe I think it might be like a golf ball has dimples, and that's to increase lift, and maybe that's what helps the baby whale after, or the gray whales after they've dived really deep, to come back up very quickly. But that's all conjecture on my part. It sort of makes you wonder that why one species of whales is a certain way and another species of whales is so different.
Did you learn anything about your own swimming? I mean, here you are, this long-distance swimmer, doing things that most of us could never in a million years do. Did you find yourself learning something about how to move through the water by watching Grayson?
You know, I think that When I was a kid, I would watch Olympic swimmers swim and see the beauty that they move effortlessly through the water. I mean, they're working tremendously hard, but because of their technique, they're just amazing. Actually, Sandy Nielsen, my roommate in college, was a gold medalist in the 100 freestyle, and she had the most beautiful freestyle stroke I'd ever seen. And so to be out there and watch this gray whale swimming and moving through the water and thinking that he has the best butterfly I've ever seen in my entire life because of the way he does the dolphin kick and the way he just moves through the water without seemingly to make kind of any kind of an impression. He just sort of streamlined through it. I think that the other part that was so amazing to me was the amount of time that he could hold his breath. You know, there were times where I was sort of lying out on the water surface with very deep water underneath me, waiting to see if this baby whale was going to come back again or not, or if he had found his mom. And that was sort of astonishing of how long they can hold their breath and how efficient they are in doing that.
What would you like people to take away from reading your book?
That there's magic in the real world, that amazing things do happen, that we have a huge impact in what happens in our lives and the lives of other people and animals around us, that we are interconnected with the environment, and that what we touch touches us back again.
Thank you, Lynn.
You're welcome.
Lynn Cox is the author of Grayson. She spoke with us today from her home in Southern California. And stay tuned. In just a bit, we're giving you a chance to win a copy of Lynn's book. And meanwhile, if you have a question for Patricia, call us at 1-800-462-7413. And as a matter of fact, someone's online, so let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Margaret Merrill in Parma, Idaho.
Margaret, thank you very much for calling. How can we help?
I would like to know how to discourage coyotes from coming around my home without shooting or trapping them. Are there sounds or scents that I can use?
Well, good for you for looking for natural methods. You know, there's so many. Coyotes do cause a lot of problems in many areas, but so many of the methods to control them are so intrusive, if not cruel, frankly. So
let me ask a question. Do you have animals outside? Is that what you're concerned?
I have cats that stay out during the day but have to come in at night.
Okay.
About 5:30 in the evening.
And there's a lot of sign of coyotes around where you live.
A lot.
Sounds like.
They circle the garden.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. They're not
We're
just
rather
howling.
We're surrounded by corn, and we think perhaps sweet corn attracts coyotes as well.
It's possible. Uh-huh. My guess is more it's the animals. That corn attracts animals that then attracts coyotes. Coyotes love little mice and small little mammals along with some larger prey. But ironic you should ask me, who was up at 2 this morning with my guard dog. So because I have a serious coyote problem and I have lambs. I have basically a coyote buffet in springtime. And I have had neighbors who have lost animals to coyotes, a calf, chickens, etc. And I have a guard dog, and I specifically got a guard dog, Tulip, a Great Pyrenees, because I have had so much problem with coyotes. I have not had a coyote put a paw on my property since I got Tulip. She's my second Great Pyrenees guard dog, actually. My first was Bo Peep, who watched her sheep very carefully. Now I should say that having a guard dog to guard your cats against coyotes is not sort of... has its own set of issues with it, in that now you have a 100-pound dog to take care of who does bark a lot at night because that's what they were bred to do. But certainly that's
one option.
That is one option, and it's a really good one for people who have serious problems with coyotes. So that's something to think about. Other animals, now I don't know if this is appropriate for you, especially if you live in a suburb and you have cats outside. Certainly, people who have larger acreage and hoofed animals often will have, they don't want a guard dog, they'll have a donkey, or how about a llama in your backyard? They can be festive and great fun. If this is more of a suburban kind of a setting, I frankly, if I had cats who are outside, I had coyotes circling my backyard, I would frankly consider building an enclosure for my cats. You know, we don't blink about having enclosure for dogs. Fences, etc. Now, obviously, you can't fence a cat like you can a dog, but there are an increasing number of sort of pre-built enclosures that you can get that allow your cat to be outside, but keep them from wandering very far and keep animals from the outside from coming in. So that's certainly something to think about. I know some people whose cats live indoors 24/7 believe very strongly that no cat should ever be allowed outside because it is so dangerous out there. I have sympathy with that, but for people whose cats have been outside for long periods of time, it can be very difficult to make that transition. Some cats do very well. Larry's did.
Mm-hmm.
Some cats make that transition very well. Others don't. And so it's not enough to just suggest to this caller that you just keep your cats inside. So one compromise, again, might be this enclosure where you let your cats outside, but they're enclosed, they can't go far, and the coyotes can't get in. Otherwise, let us know the name of your new Great Pyrenees. Good luck. I know it's a worry. And coyotes, by the way, can indeed prey upon cats. It certainly has happened before.
Good luck, Margaret. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is coming up next with your chance to win a copy of Lynn Cox's new book. And we'll take more of your calls. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And all correct guessers to this week's question will have their names pulled together. And three lucky winners will be selected at random to receive the book titled Grayson. And here's today's question. How long are baby gray whales when they are born? And we'll give you a hint. It's no more than 20 feet. So if you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And tune in to Calling All Pets next week to find out the correct answer. And for now, we're ready to take some more calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Ramona Putnam from Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Hi, Ramona. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question. What can I do to make sure my kitty cat pees in the bathtub? She did it a few times, and I was really happy because all I had to do was clean up after the bathtub. I didn't have to dump kitty litter and go through all that.
Right.
And so I was trying to get her so I could train her to do that, but she stopped doing that, and now I can't figure out how to get her to go back.
Well, here's the challenge. If there are ways to convince her to use the bathtub as a litter box, and the problem is it would involve putting litter in the box. The problem is once you train her to urinate in the bathtub, she might start to defecate it in it as well.
Well, she did a couple of times, and I took that out of the bathtub and threw it down the toilet.
And
that was actually easier than dumping litter.
So if it's okay with you that she does both, then there are two possibilities. One is you could put a small amount of litter in the bathtub. Now, that obviously for a while is going to be a lot of trouble, and that you're going to have to get the litter cleaned up won't be so easy, but it would get that habit. It would basically turn your bathtub into a litter box, and then you could make less and less litter. So that's certainly one possibility. The other is to keep in mind the fact that although we use vision as our primary sense to tell us where to go to the bathroom, you know, you're out in a restaurant, and what do? You don't sniff the air, right? Hopefully,
no.
Right? You look up, and you look for a sign that says restroom, and then you look for the sign that says ladies, and then you look for the white thing. You know, it's all visual. But with them, it's chemical. It's all chemical to them. So one thing you could do is you could take some feces, or you could take some urine. I'm not sure how you're going to get that separate from the litter, and put it in the bathtub in hopes that that would encourage her to go there again. I mean, that's why the sort of the flip side is if you have a problem is you want to make sure you clean that area up so that the odor is completely gone. So you could sort of reverse that on its head and go the other way around.
Okay.
Does that all sound possible?
Well, maybe. It's better than throwing a lot of litter in the bathtub. That would be a mess.
Yeah, that would be a real mess. This is a tricky one. The fact of the matter is when we live with cats, we've just got a biological truth to have to deal with. It's certainly the downside sometimes of having a cat. But it's usually well worth it. Right, Larry?
I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, isn't there a litter box that kind of automatically takes the litter or cleans the litter?
That's a good point. There are two other possibilities. There is a litter box. It's a bit expensive, but there's a sort of a self-cleaning litter box that every once in a while, what it does is it sifts and winnows, and basically is the waste products go down to the bottom, but you still have to empty it, Larry. You still have a tray at the bottom that you have to empty. So I don't think she'd like that any better. Then there's the old teacher cat directly to use the toilet,
which I think this listener might really like. And that works in some cases, although if you've been listening to the show a lot, you've heard me talk about cats who ended up not using their litter box anymore and not using the toilet either. Yeah. So, but that's also another possibility.
One to think about anyway. And thank you very much for calling, Ramona. You know, talking about cats and bathtubs and bathrooms and so forth, Liz from Gordon, Wisconsin, sent us a message about her calico cat's fascination with steamy showers. Liz says, when I get out of the shower, my cat walks along the rim of the tub or sometimes just sits there and stares, entranced by the water swirling around the drain. But I also notice that she hangs around the steam a lot longer in the winter when my house is much drier. So now, after towel drying my hair, I've taken to laying the wet cotton towel over her back, stroking her with it from head to tail, moistening her fur without soaking her, and she seems to appreciate the added moisture in her fur. And at that point, her interest in water is over.
I see. So it's the moisture. And I think that's a really good point. So many of us have very dry houses in winter, and it can bother us. That's why we have humidifiers. So actually, one thing that the listener who emailed might want to think about is actually getting a humidifier in winter, because if the house is dry enough that the cat is taking little saunas, but doesn't really like to seem, doesn't really like the moisture sort of for its own sake, then a humidifier actually is a great idea. But I think, Larry, that you and I have found the big bucks, you know, that we could retire on. Yeah, so we could fly to everybody and give them do house calls for all the people who call into the show, is we manufacture a kitty sauna. And we sell it for big bucks, because here's this woman whose cat likes a sauna. People like saunas. Probably some dogs out there who like saunas. Birds often suffer from dryness. So there we are. Our million is made.
And if you have some ideas about how we might make another $1 million.
There you go.
Or if you just have a pet tip for us, where do they write?
Send us those $1 million tips to pets@wpr.org.
Okay. And here's the number to call if you want a question. 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Janine from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Hi, Janine. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
What can we do for you?
My dog's country vet said dogs are not dogs anymore. And I had heard it has taken dogs 2,000 years to evolve from wild to domestic. What is going to happen in the next 2,000 years, do you think?
Wow, what a fun question.
Right.
One of the interesting aspects of your question is how long dogs have actually been dogs. And there's a lot of controversy about that. The standard idea has been actually longer than 2,000 years, has actually been 10 to 13,000 years. That's when they're first found as dog-like creatures, meaning their dentition is much smaller. And structurally, they're quite different from wild-type progenitors like Asian wolves. But some people think it's longer. Some people think it was 100,000 years ago. So whatever it is, we have a long history. And your question is really is a very good one. I don't agree necessarily with the statement, although I'm not quite sure what he or she means when your veterinarian says dogs aren't dogs anymore. They're still dogs.
Well, that's true.
They haven't changed that much. Although, you know, one thing that has changed is a lot of the selective breeding that we've done. In terms of creating different breeds with very, very different morphologies and very, very different coats, for example, we have created a lot of extremes. It's absolutely true. And some of those extremes aren't so healthy. You know, if dogs have so much skin that they have chronic, continual, relentless skin infections in between the folds of their skin, you know, that's not such a good thing.
No.
So if that's what your vet was referring to, I do think we need to be very thoughtful about some of the breeding decisions we make of sort of breeding animals to look interesting to us and not thinking about health concerns. But I think what's most changed that perhaps your veterinarian is referring to is how we think of dogs.
Right.
And how we're treating them. And there's a lot of speculation about why are people treating dogs so much better, really, is sort of the bottom line than they used to. And I think there are a variety of reasons for that. We could talk about that forever. It'd be a great topic, actually, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
One is that we know much more about the internal experience of non-human animals. And we know now, as we often didn't before, that our dogs have a rich, complex internal life, that they can experience fear and pain. And so we're more empathetic. You know, than some cultures still are, and than we used to be. I actually ran into somebody not that long ago who was watching a dog shrieking, who was badly injured, and the person actually said, "He's just a dog. He can't feel pain." and that's just a misunderstanding of biology.
Right.
But I think also many of us are disconnected from the natural world, and I don't think that's a good place to be. I don't think it makes us feel secure or happy. And one of the things that dogs do is they sort of bring all the rest of the natural world into our living rooms. And so as people become disconnected from what they're eating and the land and the plants that we're all, you know, really are connected with but don't get to feel that very much, I think dogs provide that connection. There are a lot of reasons why we're all treating dogs, many of us are treating dogs differently now.
And that's true.
And to your question about evolution and where it's going to be 2,000 years from now, I mean, the interesting thing is that we all are continuing, everything is continuing to evolve. It just didn't stop here. And who the heck knows what's going to happen 2,000 years down the road, but it's sure a lot of fun to think about, isn't it?
That's true.
And that's a great, great point, Dr. Mueller. It's a really good point, because who knows what we're going to be like 2,000 years from now? You know, evolution is, it's all it's just, the word means change, I mean, you know, and things change. So who knows, maybe we'll just be, you know, big brains and computer keyboards.
Oh, I hope not.
I wouldn't like that.
I wouldn't like
that idea at all. But, you know, but who knows?
I'm kind of glad we are just where we are right now. You know that?
If you didn't have fingers, you couldn't pet your cat or your dog. That'd be no fun.
that'd be no fun at all. But you know what? It's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun working with you this week, as always, and we'll do it again. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0818P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.